So we have here, I guess. And you know, have you ever heard of Virginians for America First?
I have not.
We're a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization whose goal is to further election integrity in Virginia.
Yes.
And a step in that direction is taking inventory of where the various registrars are.
Yeah.
So we're doing this with every county and every city in the state. So there are teams all over the state doing this thing.
Wow.
This questionnaire has been designed for the purpose of simply recording what exists, not judging what exists or whatever, but recording it.
Yeah.
So the first one there is, what is your biggest concern about the upcoming election?
I'm going to first start with my notes and then I'll elaborate on that. So, as you may know, we have had some sweeping law changes in the last year. So that creates a lot of voter confusion. You know, folks are not really sure of how things are run because so much change has happened. And so I am concerned about voter education and knowledge of what is available to them. That is probably my biggest thing. And then obviously with the current pandemic situation, I truly don't know what the expectation is. I don't know who's going to turn out, when they're going to turn out, if it will be during early voting, if it will be election day, if it will be by mail. And as an administrator, that is incredibly hard to see through a crystal ball of what's going to happen. And so that creates a unique situation where we're literally preparing on all three fronts, regardless of where somebody turns out. We're going to be available to help them. But that's probably my biggest concern, is the unknown of how things will turn out and where voters will come from, whether it be election day or early voting, and how we accommodate them. But that's kind of my thoughts on it.
So is there any secondary major concerns that you have?
Not that I can think of. First and foremost, truly, it is the law changes, because as you may be aware, from 2 years ago, I think it was, anybody who came to vote in person prior to election day had to complete an application and give an excuse. That's no longer the case.
Right.
The application is gone. There's no need for an excuse. That is a huge change in the way we function.
Yeah.
Not only that, but now this year, as of July 1st, anybody who previously voted by mail had to apply for every election. Now there's permanent. So that program has completely changed, and we're in the process of learning how to navigate that. So our goal is anybody who walks in or anybody calls or desires to vote is to give them the way to do it. So now with all these changes is, how do we provide the information so voters are aware and can come or notify us they want to vote by mail? I think that's a major issue because there have been so many changes. And even though we're required to send a notice, the voter, I had a call this morning and she said, I got your letter about my permanent absentee and I was in the hospital and I'm disabled and I still want to do this. Like, I still want to vote by mail. And I said, well, I appreciate you calling, but the letter was to notify you that you've been added to the list, but they're confused on what they're getting. The letter explicitly said, you've applied, you've been approved, you've been added. But it's just the general public confusion of, what does this mean? What are my steps? So that is a concern. And I don't know what to do. I don't know what the answer is for that, except for to continue to put the information out. So
makes sense.
So in that regard, do you have all the resources you need for that?
Yes and no. I think this is probably going to be something that you may come across in many election offices. So we are, unfortunately, or fortunately for some cases, we are locally funded, which means we are federally mandated, state mandated by code, but the county funds us.
Mm-hmm.
So these two government entities do not function under the same law or regulation. So I'm having to ask county for their for funding to do what needs to be done to best serve the public. And there is a void there. There is a lack of understanding in what we do.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of election administrators feel like they're constantly battling for funding.
Mm-hmm.
It is an issue.
Oh, sure.
We have 46,000 registered voters, and there's me and a full-time assistant, and that's it.
Yeah. How many registered?
46,000.
46,000.
We have
a large fraction of that is the military academy.
No. We have 30 polling places. We are massive because we're the largest land mass in Virginia. It can take a voter, if they were to come here to vote, it could take up to 45 minutes to get here, which to me is unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
But it's what we've been given.
Right.
So funding for sure, both at the local and the state level. You know, we want to run successful elections, and unfortunately that comes down to funding.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's just not there.
Mm-hmm.
It truly is not. We are given what I believe is the bare minimum to survive, and that's not asking for a successful election.
Right.
I have been the one to advocate to my board that regardless of the funding that is given to us, we're going to follow the law. We're going to do our jobs. And if that means that our budget is in the negative, so be it. I don't look good in orange, you know.
Yeah.
I don't want to be on the front page of the newspaper. I don't. And I come to work every day to make sure that that is what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in addition to that, and it kind of goes along with it, and like I had said to you about our staff, is we have temporary staff that are on payroll that myself and my board have asked for additional full-time or full or permanent staff,
mm-hmm.
and we've continued to be denied.
Mm.
And my mindset is this. Having a temporary individual to come in is great. You have a body, but you don't have a knowledgeable, trained individual in the code that could meet somebody mm-hmm. and answer any question mm-hmm. they have.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So then how do we look?
Right.
You know? Yeah.
And I've had it happen. I've had a temporary member be in the office, answer the phone, and give incorrect information.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just out of the not knowing, and we needed somebody to answer the phone.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't for any other reason than that. But I've said that repeatedly. You know, you can't expect the best service from someone who literally walks in the week before we start voting and know all the answers.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not the case.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that is definitely something. And another thing is if you look at how elections have grown in the last decade and how the administration of an election has changed in the last decade, it is so much more responsibility and checks and balances and audit checks and reviews that this is no longer a one-person show. This is no longer a two-person show. And you want accountability there. It just means you need more people involved.
Mm, right.
That's what it comes down
mm-hmm.
to. But that's probably my biggest concern with funding for sure.
Yeah.
So I think that answers 3 and 4.
Okay.
How about the composition of the board? The balance that you have right now, according to your website, is 2 Democrats and a Republican.
Yes.
And I suppose that is in fact what you have.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. All 3 board members have been on board for a number of years. Our secretary is the Republican representative. She's been on since I think 2006. Our Democratic chairman has been on for, I think this is her third term, so that would be almost 9 years. Mm-hmm. And then our newest member has been on for two terms as well, so that would have been 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
So they are, even though we don't always see eye to eye, we work well together.
Mm-hmm.
And we all have the same understanding that it is for the voter to voice their opinion, and that's it. But we do have, the chairman is a Democrat, the vice chairman is a Democrat, and the secretary is a Republican, and that's the way it's been for, as far as I can remember, for decades.
Mm-hmm.
That's mm-hmm. been the case. But yeah.
Okay.
So you talked about staffing. Mm-hmm. The temp workers are the election day staff?
No. Well, yes and no. So, the precinct staff is something that is more or less managed by the electoral board. So we have a process by which an individual who is interested fills out an interest form. We verify that they are registered, and then ask them a preference on where they wish to serve.
Mm-hmm.
It's then gone before the board, and there have been many discussions on whether or not, you know, somebody with this representation for this party should serve at this location. Now, unfortunately, I'm in a predicament where I can't advertise that we need this representation at this polling place.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes from within the community. So we do have some locations that are predominantly Republican, and we have some locations that are predominantly Democrat. Now, when we can, we try and at least have one at every location.
Mm-hmm.
So there is some, you know, equalization there. We find it extremely hard, unfortunately, to get more folks involved. The other thing that we do is reach out to the parties. The Republican Party chair and I, well, both of them, I've built relationships with both of them. And so we will send a list out and say, these are the people that are working the polls. If you know of anybody, we need people at these locations, please send them our information.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the times we don't get anything back, but at least we're letting the folks know
uh-huh.
we need the help.
Mm-hmm.
So what you said is that there's, in some polling locations, it's not one and one.
It is, but it's not like let's say I have seven people working at one location. I'm not going to have three of each party.
Right.
Is what I'm trying to say.
But you think you have at least one of each
party.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. There is at least one of each party.
Okay. Seven is the frequency of meetings or actions by the board.
So I would say it is year round, but also mostly near elections. The board does meet, but they meet as required by code.
Mm-hmm.
So the code requires they meet in February. The code requires they meet to set, you know, testing dates and training dates. And then whenever there are issues that need to be discussed and addressed, we will meet and hold those meetings. So
mm-hmm.
it's not a set schedule. It's more of, you know, we meet as the election cycles come or as an issue arises.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's good. In terms of a voter file and the county scrubbing, how does that work here?
So we use a statewide database to process all registrations. And so I think it's the Department of Elections that is required to do this annually or biannually. That is the National Voter Registration. In addition to that, we also do a monthly, like I just got September's calendar for different types of checks and balances, like a deceased hopper or a felon hopper. These are things that verify the information is accurate.
Mm-hmm.
So the last time that I know we did an address confirmation was in June. But the data is reviewed monthly to make sure that things are kept up to date as best we can.
So then I think that answers 9A, that monthly you get reports from...
From the state.
Regarding deaths or...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That comes with deaths, that comes with anybody who goes to DMV and checks the box that they're not a citizen. We get every one of those. And then we also get the information from any naturalization ceremony. So we get all that information on a monthly basis.
Okay.
There's also called the ERIC program. That is, I think it's a quarterly program. The ERIC program is a multi-state database where... If you go to DMV in Virginia and 2 months later you go to DMV in North Carolina, we get that information. So that helps to keep you registered in the correct state.
How about number 10, how often do you get information about individuals who declined to serve on jury duty because they were non-citizens?
To my knowledge, that's never happened. But I will say that the clerk gets, they send out notices, and if a person comes back, if a letter comes back undeliverable or with a different address, they do forward that information on to us. But we've never, to my knowledge, gotten anything that says that somebody is a non-citizen. But like I said, we do have several programs that give us that information. So it's something that we see, but not as often as I think people would imagine.
I don't even know if the clerk sees that that person has a responsibility for informing you on this.
Yeah.
Yes. And I can tell you that the clerk probably is not aware. I can tell you that this clerk is fairly new, great to work with. The previous clerk was there for 28 years, and so he worked with the previous registrar, and I could imagine there was some communications there, but I think it was more or less the address changes that we would get. I remember seeing a document that was sent, but what the details of it was, and it's been a number of years. But I would be more than glad to reach out. We have a close working relationship. Anything that we need or they need, we have several folks that will come by here or go by there, and they're in the process of getting their voting rights restored and or their gun rights back. And so the two go hand in hand. You have to get your civil rights back before you get your gun rights back. Well, they had been referring them to us for them to go through the process for voter registration restoration. And as if it was something that I had the power to do, and I don't. So I just let them know, this is the information, this is the website, this is where you can go. So hopefully that kind of corrects it. But I will, I know Mark very well, so I'll just contact him and say, hey, if you get this, can you send it on to me?
Yeah, okay.
So how about national change of address list?
So that is what I referred to as the NCOA. It's the acronym for it. It was completed in, well, we got the information in July of 2021. I think we had several hundred what we call in-jurisdiction changes, which is where somebody notified the DMV or the Postal Service that they moved from one household in Pittsylvania County to another. And so all of those have been updated, and the voter has been sent a notice that their information has been changed. We're now in the process of receiving any of the notices that were mailed to voters. This is out-of-state people. This is people that may have moved in another location within the state. So as they come in, they're processed daily.
So you notify people that you know have moved? And
yes,
you sent them a letter and ask them if they should be removed?
Yes.
And then you wait for a response from them?
Yes.
And at that point, you remove them?
Yes.
Okay.
So code requires I have the voter's signature in order to remove somebody. So unless it's an NVRA purge, which is totally different requirement. Now, if somebody has physically moved, I can't deny them or cancel them until I have their signature identifying that, yes, they have in fact moved. So what the NCOA does is, let's say, you know, a family member moves to North Carolina and they get the notice in the mail in North Carolina that says, hey, we have record that you've moved out of state, please respond. Mm. And so then at that point, they're required to come in and fill out the form and go from there.
Mm-hmm. Do they have to come in or could they do it by
mail?
No,
they could mail. Okay. It's a form that we mail to them that they could sign. Did you need something?
Yeah, I saw it. I need a key to this right here.
Just a second. Okay.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
No problem.
Sure.
No worries. They're in the process of checking our security system and our evacuation plan. So. Okay. It's okay.
So, except to the extent that each action takes time, it sounds like you're saying that the answer to number 12A is that you've got things as up to date as they can be.
Yeah. We do as much as we can, you know, within the confines of the law to make sure that the information is as up to date as possible. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it's not perfect. I don't know what a perfect system looks like, and that's anywhere you go. But, you know, I think, and I don't know if you're aware of this, but 4 years ago, we were not doing online voter registration. We did not have an electronic format to transfer data from DMV to the Virginia Department of Elections. And in 2016, that developed. So a lot of what we deal with now is a lot less paper applications mm-hmm. where you have to decipher somebody's handwriting. Mm-hmm. And now it's all electronic copy by a transaction at the DMV. Mm-hmm. Every one of them is recorded and we get every one of them. So it automates a lot of things and it definitely makes it more accurate. But that's mm-hmm. also trusting the DMV is
saying. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
What they said at DMV.
I'll just be honest. Yeah. It's all a work in progress. But yes, we absolutely do as much as possible to make sure that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So how about, I guess we're up to 13 here.
Okay.
Households with more than 7 individuals registered.
I truly am not aware. And I don't even know how I could pull that information from the system. However, more than likely, there are several long-term healthcare facilities,
right,
like rehabs and things of that nature.
And that's the most common thing.
Yeah. Like Hargrave, they have staff on site. Mm-hmm. So that's mm-hmm. the military
right.
academy. They're going to have mm-hmm. it. Chatham Hall, they have it. Those are just areas that I've dealt with over the years mm-hmm. that you can clearly see. But as far as a physical household, I've never seen that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a good
sign.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you, during registration, and how do you, if so, verify that voters are citizens?
So, like I had said a little bit ago, we are given vital records that come from either a DMV transaction or naturalization ceremony type thing. But on every single application, it's the very first question. And the voter is signing, the applicant is signing under a felony penalty that they are seeing what's on the application is true. If the application does come back and that question is not answered, it's automatically denied.
Mm-hmm.
If they answer no, it's automatically denied. If we process the application and the system says this person has been identified as non-citizen, it's denied. And that's just the daily practice of ours.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. New area here, types of voting machines.
Okay. So we use it's called Election Systems and Software. It's called ESNS. We use an optical scan machine, which is a paper-based voting machine. It's a DS200, which is just the model of the piece of equipment, which is just a scanner. We have recently upgraded our handicap equipment. We used to use what we called an auto mark, which is an older piece of technology. So trying to advance that and be more secure, we decided to go with an express vote, which has been used in the state for a number of years. And that is is more of a easier, I think, and more user-friendly. I know for us, the old machine was 45 pounds. The new machine is 22 pounds.
Mm.
So it's a much smaller footprint. But essentially, all that piece of equipment is an assistive device for someone who is blind or disabled to vote completely in secret without the assistance of any other human being.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the same the other machine did. It's just it was a much older type of technology.
Mm-hmm.
Neither machine does hold votes. It doesn't keep a record of what somebody selected. It's just a big printer with a screen, essentially. Mm-hmm. But the DS-200 is what we hold, what holds all the voted ballots, and those are all obviously tested and maintained prior to every election.
Mm-hmm.
So who calibrates these machines?
So it's usually a 2 to 3 day process. It is usually done in-house. My electoral board is involved in that process. Usually it's myself, my assistant, 3 board members, and sometimes, like I know this election, since we have new equipment, we're going to have a member of our, vendor support. They're going to come and assist us because since it's our first time with this piece of equipment, I want to make sure we don't leave anything out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's more for the ADA stuff than the assistive device, than the regular voting machine. But typically, so we have 36 DS-200s and 36 express votes. And it does take quite a bit of time.
Mm-hmm.
So we schedule that in, we notify the parties, and then we go in for testing. And sometimes we can finish in 2 days. Just depends on how fast things move along.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So you covered number 17 as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, witnesses to the calibration.
They notify the parties. So parties are invited to come.
Yes, they are.
To the
calibration.
Yes, to the testing of the equipment.
Yeah.
Yes.
And when they're invited, do they attend?
It varies. We have had change of the chairman position from both parties, and some are more involved than others. We have had folks from both parties come. More often than not, they don't attend.
They don't.
Yeah. Hmm. It truly is something that, and it could be maybe because of the relationship that the chairmans have with the electoral board and have with our staff. You know, they're aware that if something is wrong or if something didn't go the way it was supposed to, then we would notify them, obviously. That's just transparency. But there hasn't been any issues, and we do send them a date and the time of the testing.
All right. Are the machines ever connected to the internet?
No, sir. I think it's actually against Virginia law, and there is even in the manufacturing and development, there's not a modem installed at all on the piece of equipment.
And there's no place where a flash drive can be inserted from which data would be read?
Not that would be open to the public, no. That is done in a secured environment. That is done with media that is programmed specifically for the election and then tested and then sealed. Mm-hmm. So that is our process. But there is not a USB port that is open to anyone on election day or any time thereafter. Mm-hmm. So you have the physical security of only but so many people can get access to them, and then only so many people have access to the keys to get in them. We try and have several layers.
Right.
Okay.
So is that how then the machines are updated through that process?
Yes. So we have a contract with, even though we do use ESNS, they are the manufacturer of the DS-200. In Virginia and North Carolina, it's a company called Printelect. They are our immediate vendor that supports this equipment. So they, we have a contract, an annual service and maintenance contract. So they come every year, usually in August, and they will come and go through every piece of equipment, do any required upgrades, review, make sure that the batteries are still functioning and the belts are still good, and everything still works prior to us testing. And then obviously we test before every election. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that is something that's done every year.
And they use a port on the machine to load new software or whatever.
Sometimes, yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Okay. As an election professional, do you think the changes made in the process in Virginia in response to COVID have weakened integrity, strengthened it, or made no change?
I think to some degree it has strengthened the integrity. I think that is mainly because we provide a tested and verified option for voters to vote and be involved in the election process while still attempting to keep everyone safe. I think when...
Could you repeat that?
I'm not sure I understand what you said. So we provide a tested and verified option. So this is...
Which is?
So it is everything from every piece of equipment that is used.
Uh-huh.
It is everything from every ballot that is printed. These are things that there are checks and balances in place to make sure that when you receive that packet in the mail... If you follow the instructions you're given, your ballot will be counted. I've seen tens of thousands of ballots be counted by mail, and this is to try and keep people safe. In addition to that, last year we had a vote center. So because we were in a much smaller space last year,
mm-hmm.
and because of COVID restrictions, you can only have two people in our office at one time.
Mm.
And with 46,000 people, that just wasn't going to do. So we went out here to the Ag Center on 29, and we rented that for a month and a half.
Wow.
And we saw 15,000 people come through the door. And my goal is for anyone to walk in that is legally registered and there to make their choice to come in, have a pleasant experience, not to be standing in line, to be given a ballot, and for that ballot to be counted as they choose.
Mm.
That's my goal.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing that we were able to successfully serve 20,000 people either by mail or in person, to me feels like we can stand on that and continue to build mm-hmm. from it. That's really how I feel mm-hmm. about it. You know, I don't want to put anybody down, but I was in a meeting recently, and you know, a registrar friend of mine said last year when the DMV closed and social services closed and local, state, and governments closed, we had to keep our doors open.
Mm-hmm.
We were told if somebody was COVID positive, we couldn't turn them away.
Is that right?
Yes.
You mean a voter?
Yes. Yes. We were told we had to keep our doors open. So.
Was that a countywide or a statewide?
That was a statewide. Well, The information came down from the Department of Elections because obviously as election administrators, we were concerned.
Mm.
Because, so just to give you some background, in last year, the deadline to apply for a ballot was 10 days prior to the election by mail, okay? So let's say you are infected or asked to quarantine after that deadline. I legally can't mail you a ballot. The only option you have to come and enact your civil right is to do it in person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I also can't make you vote in the car.
Mm-hmm.
No, you didn't have curbside voting.
We did. We did. But I can't make someone not vote.
Come
inside.
In and vote on.
Right.
If that's your choice.
Now, we tried to be graceful in that literally, I don't want to take your right away. I don't. What I want to do is protect the people that are here, that are mm-hmm. serving, that are helping, and their families. So out of respect and safety, if you have been asked to quarantine or you have tested positive, please, please, please pull up to the curbside And when we come out to assist you, please say, I've been asked to quarantine. I've tested positive. I still want to vote. That gives us the opportunity to protect ourselves and still give you the opportunity. Mm-hmm. And we had over 400 cases that we served in person. And nobody got sick.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, yes. A lot of people don't realize, you know, even now, DMV, you can do so many things online now. You can't do voting online. You can't. It has to be done with the human interaction.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one thing we can't take away.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we do it and still be safe?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's what we're continuing to try to do.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, you already talked about funding and the county and state issues.
Yes.
I take it. Or do you have any other outside sources, outside of Virginia sources of funding?
So, yes, in the past, from what I understand. So, real quick, when we were looking into buying the Express Vote for the handicap, that is a $130,000 investment.
Oh.
Yes, it's massive. Just for 30 pieces of equipment to offer to a handicapped voter. $130,000 just to purchase, and then it's probably about $6,000 a year just for maintenance. So when we were looking at upgrading, even though I had asked for a number of years for this to be put in, capital improvement is something in elections administration, systems age, new technology comes on. So we've been trying to get the county to plan for either an 8 or a 10 year plan. Every 8 years you replace the system. If you save $50,000 over 8 years, you have the money to replace the system. It's $500,000 to replace a voting system here. So we, when that came up, the county had not put that funds aside. So they wanted me to look for grants. So I reached out to the EAC, I reached out to Center for Tech and Civic Life, asking if there was any election security grants to be able to fund this. And we were denied on every account, on every request. So the county then found the money.
Interesting.
So, yeah. Now last year, as you may be aware, Center for Tech and Civic Life, it's CTCL for short, did offer a grant for specifically for the 2020 election in November. And I was trying to figure out how to administer an election in the current facility we were in and still keep people safe. And a way was made because I applied for the grant, we were given $39,000, and that paid for the Ag Center. That paid for the rent and the 12 staff and the additional voting machines, and that's where we saw 15,000 people come through the door.
That's a break.
Was that a federal grant? A state grant?
That was not a state grant. I want to say maybe it was a federal. It's I don't know how to categorize it.
You'd have to look into that organization.
It's called Center for Tech and Civic Life. I think there were multiple registrars that applied.
I'm sorry,
You're fine. There were several. And so you just applied with what your needs were. And like I said, 90% of it went to nothing but funding that vote center. PPE, of course, and then the supplies, because you have to manage everything from start to finish.
Do you hear that? I'm sorry. I don't know when I'm hearing something. If I'm hearing it through
Bluetooth, it goes through his ear.
Hearing aid or what?
Yeah. Okay. No, we don't hear it.
Okay. All right. So question 21.
This one confuses me a little bit. The elimination for witness for absentee ballots, according to this question, has to do only with state of emergency. Do you agree with that?
Okay. Yes, correct.
And the governor rescinded that.
Correct.
And so Do you see then that you now have a responsibility to see a witness signature on the absentee ballot?
Absolutely.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, that is that, and that has been discussed statewide. That is something that the state has sent down that. Excuse me, just a second. The state did verify, because there were some questions with that, because obviously last year was a different scenario with sort of the start of the pandemic and the fact that we were under a state of emergency. But the code there explicitly says that it does waive the requirement for a witness signature only during a state of emergency. Mm. We're no longer there.
Right.
Now, I can say I don't know what the future holds. If mid-October they come back and they reenact it, then the witness mm-hmm. signature goes away.
Mm-hmm.
And we're already midstream, have already mailed hundreds of ballots. But really and truly, and you may be aware of this or not, but we are also required to cure ballots now within 3 days.
To what ballot?
To cure them. Cure it. So what that means is when the ballot comes back, it's in an outer mail envelope. We are required to open it to verify there is, in fact, an envelope with a voter signature in there. Part of that verification or that curing is we verify that all the required areas on the back of the envelope are completed. So full name, full address, full signature, and in this case, witness signature. If those things are not completed, we are required to notify the voter within 3 days of us finding the error and receiving the ballot. Yes, and that is statewide.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what we believe, and I've learned this the hard way in my previous profession, is when or if I ever have to go to court and defend a decision or an action that was made, my belief is two sets of eyes are always harder to question than one.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a verification process. Two people see everything. So that helps to say, okay, I see it this way. How do you see it? And if we agree, then we agree. If we don't, then it goes to a third person.
Is it a requirement that they be from different parties?
No. Well, we're staff.
Office staff.
Yeah.
Oh, it's office staff.
Yeah, I'm not. Now, when this is first review, so this is a cure process that is required by our administrative staff, which is me and my deputy. So normally if I go get the mail, I will open, verify, and I will pull the ones that look incomplete, and we have a cure sheet. So we have to write all the voter's information on it, clip the ballot envelope to it, and say, here, look at this, tell me what you see. And if they agree, then they sign the form, and then the notice goes to the voter. Now, let's say we send the notice to the voter, they don't respond. We send a second notice, they don't respond. Yeah. Election day comes, the voter's been given
two notices.
Well, they've been given a ballot and then two notices that their ballot came back and it's not complete.
Mm-hmm.
We do, by code, have the ability to reissue a set. So sometimes what I will do is, and I think this is going to become a normal practice of ours, is we will hold the incomplete ballot set, mail them a notice with a new ballot set and say, complete this or this will be counted. Now, if they return this ballot set, then this one is voided. Only one is counted. But we verify that and give them the opportunity to correct it. Because you think about the person that is homebound, that is a quadriplegic. They're not going to be able to come here in person and sign the document that they forgot to sign, and I can't mail it to them.
Mm-hmm.
So the only opportunity they have is to send them a brand new set and have them fix it. And then the one that was incomplete is then voided, and the one that's complete is counted.
Mm-hmm.
But that is something that we truly do try and make sure that there are two sets of eyes. Typically, I review the signatures and make sure that the envelopes are reviewed. or that everything is complete. And if it's not, I'm usually the one that sends the notices. But it's like I review, I have somebody else review, and then I mail, mm-hmm. just as a verification.
Mm-hmm. And the staff involved in this, you say, is mm-hmm. just you and your assistant.
Yes. And now coming to the week, now this is done, you know, anywhere from 5 weeks before the election to the week of the election, because we're receiving ballots daily. So the week before the election, we have what we call our vote by mail cap team. That's a group of election officials that work just in the vote by mail center. And they are of equal representation. I had six or seven last year, because we mailed over 7,000 ballots. This year it will probably only be 4, because I don't have nearly as many. But what they will do is, this is after we've gone through the process, is then they are the representation that decides. They are the final authority to say whether that ballot is counted or not. Mm-hmm. They have the authority to reject it. I don't. All I can do is cure it and say this is complete or incomplete. Mm-hmm. And then we send it to them as it is on election day, and it's up to them to decide. Mm-hmm.
So the training you've described is by extended coaching and practice.
Yes, absolutely. I think that if I'm going to be honest with you, I don't know if you all are aware of this, but last year the General Assembly had a special session in August, and the only law that passed was an election law. Within 3 weeks of us starting voting. So there were days that I would walk in the office and I would say to my staff, I don't know how we're going to do this. I don't know how we're going to do it, but we're going to figure it out together. And some things is trial by error. Some things it's, you know, we read the code aloud and we read the directives that the state has set and we do it together. And then you say next year, I'm going to do that a little bit different because it's going to be easier if we do it this way. Mm-hmm. But we were literally thrown into the fire last year. Oh, but yes, gosh. there's a lot of training. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, things change so fast that sometimes you're not given the time mm-hmm. to even embrace it to be able to train. So mm-hmm. you do it together.
Yeah.
Okay. What about the drop boxes? Do you have them, and do you have a chain of custody procedure?
Yes. There is one out here in our lobby where you came in. It is marked official ballot drop box with our times and hours.
That's the only one?
No. Oh. So the front door, as you may have noticed, is not ADA accessible. It's not handicapped. So we have one in our lobby for those folks that are not handicapped. We also have one at the exterior of our back door. So it's outside. It is ADA accessible. They don't have to come in the building, so they have the option of one or the other. So we have one at our exterior door and one at our lobby. Both are under 24-hour security surveillance, and we made the decision to only offer it during business hours, out of, you know, obviously election security. I understand the idea of having it open after hours for the person who's driving home from work and just wants to drop it off. I get that. But I don't want to leave something open that has people's votes in it. I mm-hmm. just don't. So what we do every morning is, again, two staff members will go to each one and they will open it, verify there's nothing inside, and they'll complete a verification form. And then at the end of the day at 5:00, a team of two will do the same thing. They take the ballots out, they count them, they verify this is how many they've received, and then I get the ballot collection sheets every day. So we have a record of how many ballots we've received every day.
And a video of the box at all times.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And who reviews the videos? Do you review them?
So I typically do. Unfortunately, it is set that whenever somebody goes to the back door, I'm given an alert so I can watch the recording.
Oh, okay.
Which is great, except for when the cat's there at 3 a.m.
Right.
And I get the alert.
Wow.
But hey, there is cause for it, and I I am grateful that we have it. And, you know, for the person that doesn't want to come, that can't be here between 9 and 5, I would just say that the code does not require the voter themselves drop it off in the drop box, so they can have a family member do it. And it also has prepaid return postage on it. It doesn't cost them anything to put it in their mailbox.
And these are the only two drop boxes that you have in the county, is that correct?
Yes, prior to Election Day. These are, and this is again state code, this is statewide. We are required to offer a drop box location at every polling place on Election Day.
On Election Day only?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And those are monitored?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Video.
They're not video monitored. So we're given the option to do, because if I'm being honest, logistically, administratively, I don't have the authority to put a security camera in a school cafeteria.
Right.
I just don't.
Right.
Or in a fire department or in a church.
Right.
I just don't. So what the code allows is it has to be staffed by two election officials at all times.
Okay.
So there are two people within eyesight of it at the table or sitting there at it.
And they're both from different parties?
Yes.
Okay, that's important too.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay.
The other important question there is with the cat who disturbed the drop box, a registered voter.
Yes.
Yeah, <go ahead.
laughs> Yes. Full disclosure here. No. that's okay. We'll just say he was here to visit.
All right. Okay, we're on to 25 here.
Okay.
Do you participate in the Election Day Page program?
Yes. So several years ago, I was the assistant at the time, and there was a gentleman who came onto our board and was very actively involved and wanted to get students involved. So it's probably been about a decade. He created the program from another electoral board in the state that had given them some information. At one point, we had 35 kids come and be a part of the program.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that obviously since COVID, we have put the program on hold only because mm-hmm. of that. Now, obviously, if there is an interest and there is a need and an interest, then we would be glad to have them. I'm very cautious. I hate to say that, but you know, I will say that I believe it's 4, maybe 5 off the top of my head, area high schools. And so every summer, late summer, early fall, like August, July, August, we will send a packet to the superintendent and then one to each counselor and government teacher within the high schools, giving them the information for the PAGE program and the applications for the kids. And they have to submit an essay they have to submit a written submission as to why they want to serve. 9 times out of 10, we get more back from the government students than we will just the regular high school students.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to be more interested, and some of which have turned into election officials of ours.
That's good.
Okay.
Okay. Do you have any nonpartisan people asking to be election observers?
Not currently, that I'm aware of. There has been some emails in the state going around about folks asking about that. I specifically myself haven't. But any non-partisan election observer would be someone that they would have to come to either myself or the electoral board and ask, and then it would be addressed on a case-by-case basis. Some locations, you know, like the schools and the fire departments, they're not but so big, and we are required to allow one representative from each party and or one representative from each independent candidate.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, and with some local elections, we could have up to 15 people standing around watching.
Yeah.
And at that point, is it intimidating to the voter?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if it comes up and it is something that somebody wants to do, then we'll definitely take a look at it.
Mm-hmm. And any international observers?
Not that I know of. It's never been anything that's been brought up. I was a part of the, it's a National Election Administration Certification Training. And there's a gentleman from California who is a native of Mexico. And he runs elections in California. And he went and observed the Mexican election in Mexico and mm-hmm. had a ball. So I think it kind of opens your eyes to the different ways that different people do things. I'm not going to say I'm not going to open our door, but I'm not going to say I am going to open our door.
So, yeah.
You know, it's going to be one of those things where I don't want to hinder someone, but I want to make sure we're doing the right thing.
Right. And there's no law cited here in that regard.
No.
No.
How about you notify party chairs that they're entitled to send observers?
Yes. Yeah, they are very well aware. As a matter of fact, if I'm being honest, I see clear planning on their part to place observers of party representation at locations that are typically a lower turnout of that party mm-hmm. to try and draw support.
Uh-huh.
I've seen it on several occasions.
That's good.
Yeah.
And is there a publication or explanation booklet or whatever that you provide to them?
The rights and responsibilities of observers. So yeah, The State Board of Elections does provide what we call a do's and don'ts for campaigners.
Mm-hmm.
That is printed, that is given to the parties have it. When a candidate comes in and files any kind of forms or paperwork, we give that to them
mm-hmm.
So that they're aware of it. And then it's also posted at the polling place, and it's something that we train our officers on so that they're aware. Yep. So that we try and get the information out to as many as possible, because as you can imagine, I hate to say this, but more for a local election than for a national election, people get really upset.
Mm.
They get so entrenched in believing for their candidate, and it's we have three Board of Supervisor races that are all contested that are a major deal right now.
Mm.
And these people are going to show up, and they're going to be. I've had a phone call where I've had two outside campaigners screaming, "Vote for so and so, vote for so and so," and one would holler, the other would holler.
Mm.
One would, and I'm like, "Do you realize what you're doing?
Yeah. How does that help you?"
Yeah, no.
Yeah. So, you know, I try, and now the code and or the do's and don'ts doesn't necessarily address that. It does say you have to be within 300 feet to use a loudspeaker, but I just thought that was funny. But we have had more calls on election day for local elections that'll say so-and-so is following a voter to the door. They're inside the 40 feet, and they're not supposed to. So then we send a board member out there and we try to address mm-hmm. it and say this is the perimeter, and you know, please be respectful of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would like you to know that I'm impressed by the quality of your process and answers.
Yes.
And I wonder, do you have anything else you want us to know?
You know, personally, I will just say that I wholeheartedly believe in this process. If the general public had any idea the months that we spend, the mm-hmm. hours that we spend preparing for this,
mm-hmm.
The joke in the election community is it becomes our Super Bowl, because you train and you process and you create manuals, you create programs, you test, you verify, you maintain, and then election day comes and months worth of work
is all down to one day.
Yeah, you see the results of it. And so it's kind of like a pass or fail, not really, mm-hmm. but you know, but there's not very many professions where you can see, oh, I should have trained more on that, or mm-hmm. oh, should have did that mm-hmm. differently. And it doesn't make national news, but these right. are things that I see as an administrator that I could definitely do better. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you that registrars across this state have put their lives and the lives and the health of their families at risk for this job.
Yeah, I believe
it. And we have been, especially now, I will say this, and this is just fact. Pennsylvania County is historically a 3-to-1 Republican turnout. That's what we are. Mm-hmm. And the statistics show that. So at the result of the 2020 election, the majority of the residents of this county wholeheartedly believed that the election was rigged, mm-hmm. that their vote was not counted. And I, myself, was threatened, was persecuted, was cursed out multiple times, yes. I was told that I should resign. I was told that I don't know how to do my job. I was told things that people of everyday citizens have no clue what we did to make it happen. Mm-hmm. It was by far the most successful election I've ever run mm-hmm. because there were so many people that paid so close attention. I hired 23 people, and that's what it took to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
But
23 people to
run the election, mm-hmm. Just administratively between the vote center that we had and voting by mail, and then I had I had one person just assigned to PPE, because mm-hmm. I had to get 600 sets made.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. But that's how you have to divide and conquer. Right. That's the only way right. you get through.
Yeah.
And I would have not made it without that.
Right.
I truly yeah. wouldn't have.
Yeah.
But it's there are a lot of people that love this job because mm-hmm. of its complexity, because of I don't come to work every day and do the same thing.
And it's important. Right. It's a yeah. very important job.
It is. It yeah. is. And I've faced some hard obstacles between local administration and myself. It's just made my skin tougher.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with dealing with people. You know, the unfortunate thing is you can get 1,000 people that say, thank you, you're doing a great job. And then everybody will jump on that one that wants to fuss about something.
Of course.
This is always the case.
But honey, you're never, no matter what you do, you're not going to please everybody.
That's right. Well,
do what you can.
Well, we really,
thank you so much.
Yes, we really appreciate Kelly yeah, that you took yeah. this time.
Absolutely.
We're very impressed.
Thank you.
So where did you
this meeting of Virginia went to that.
Yeah.